Nice to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're going to turn our attention to astronomy now with Jim Lattice, director of the UW-Madison Space Place and faculty associate with the UW-Madison Department of Astronomy. Space Place is located 2300 South Park Street. So really pleased to have Jim back, as we are. Tom Hall, optics specialist with Eagle Optics in Middleton. And they come by once a month or every other month or so to talk with us about what's going on out there in the sky. And certainly if you have some questions as we move along today, join in at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. If you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Jim Lattice, welcome back.
Hi, Larry. Great to be here.
And Tom Hall, thank you for coming by as well.
Good morning, Larry.
We can talk, we can talk optics as well today, as well as talking about the Saturn and the Milky Way and places like that. So join in if you have an optics question, and we'd love to hear those as well. What's happening out there in the sky right now? Are there some neat things going on, Jim Lattice?
Oh, well, there's always something neat going on. Yeah, this time of year, we're looking out into the springtime, what I think of as the springtime sky for our hemisphere anyway. And we're looking out of the, when you look up, I don't know, about 10 p.m. or something like that, you go out and look straight up, and you're looking right out of the galaxy. The Milky Way, the Milky Way you won't see up there because it's around our horizon. And that's the plane of our galaxy. So about this time of year is when we're closest to being to having our horizon in the plane of the galaxy. So that means when you look up, you're looking out of the galaxy, and that's where deep sky astronomers find lots and lots of galaxies out there, because we're looking far off beyond our own galaxy. And of course, the sun is orbiting in the galaxy, around the center of mass, the collective center of mass of the galaxy. And as Cygnus is rising over there in the east, if you look over there towards Cygnus, you're looking in the direction that we're orbiting. So it's a time of year when it really comes home to us where we are in the galaxy, what our relationship is to the plane of the galaxy and the direction. What you don't get is an impression of where we are. You can't tell that we're on the outskirts of the galaxy rather than towards the center of it, because it looks pretty much uniform to the eye all around. But off there to your if you're facing Cygnus, off to your right, you're pointing off towards the center of the galaxy, towards Sagittarius. So this is a good time of year to get in touch with your inner galaxy, I started to say. With the galactic neighborhood.
Oh, that's great. Well, Saturn's looking kind of interesting.
Saturn is really neat these days. It actually was closest and brightest to us back in February, and it moves much more slowly. It takes Saturn about 30 years to orbit the sun one time. Obviously, it takes Earth 1 year to orbit the sun one time. So we move out rather quickly once we're lined up with Saturn, which is what opposition means. Earth moves ahead pretty fast, and we get further and further away from that straight-on view, and we're approaching the view that's 90 degrees away from the sun when we look out at Saturn. And so that means the shadows out at Saturn are most visible to us. So the shadow of the rings on the planet and the shadow of the planet on the moons, we can see the moons pass through the shadow of the planet, be eclipsed, we say, by the planet. So that that point is called quadrature. When you get right at 90 degrees, it doesn't have to be right at 90 degrees, but in the neighborhood of 90 degrees, that's when viewing can be really interesting, especially with Saturn. It looks real dramatic that way. So when you have an opportunity to go look at the sky through a telescope, for example, at Space Place, we do this on the second and fourth Friday evenings of the month, and the astronomy department does it up at Sterling Hall on the roof, now that Washburn Observatory is closed for a little while, on the first and third Wednesday evenings of the month. So lots of opportunities when the sky is clear, obviously, to get a look at Saturn these days.
And Tom Hall, can we do it? Can we get a good look with something that we could buy at a place like Eagle Optics?
You can, sure. And the nice thing about Saturn, though, is the larger aperture you get, the better. So it really is a good time to go down to Space Place and, you know, look at some of the equipment that can really pull Saturn in and get those dramatic views.
Yeah, I would think so. I didn't give the number, so let me do that. If you'd like to join in, I don't think I gave it, so I'll give it right now. It's 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments as we talk optics and astronomy with our two guests, Tom Hall and Jim Lattice. And by the way, also, you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Give us a call. And there's a meteor shower, is there not, mm-hmm. expected to come that we're going to have a chance to see?
Yeah,
pretty soon, I think.
Pretty soon. Early in May. I think the peak is around May 5th, and that's the shower called the Eta Aquarids. The names don't usually tell you too much, except that it gives you a clue about which constellation needs to be above the horizon before mm-hmm. you can see these meteors very well. But most of the time, the general rule with meteors is between midnight and dawn. And another general rule is you don't really have to know where to look in the sky.
Yeah.
The name of the constellation comes from what's called the radiant point, but the paths of the meteors look progressively better the further away you get from that constellation. So you don't really need to look at the constellation to see the meteors. You'll see them all overhead. So that's the Eta Aquarids are interesting because meteor showers happen when the Earth crosses the orbit of a comet. And the a comet is a comets are really nasty little creatures that scatter pieces of themselves all along. They're like people that throw junk out of the window of their car or something like that. Comets are falling apart in the orbit, and so there's debris, little particles of debris that are scattered all along the orbit of a comet. So even if the comet's not there, when the Earth passes crosses the orbit of the comet, then we run into those things, and those little bits burn up in our atmosphere, and we see meteors. So we see a lot of them when we cross the orbit. So this particular comet is an interesting one because everybody's heard of it. This is Comet Halley, mm-hmm. and the Earth crosses Halley's path twice during the year, and we get in the spring we get the Eta Aquarids, and in the fall we get the Orionids. So those are the two points where we pick up a little bit of comet dust, although none of it makes it to the surface.
But it's a lot of fun to watch. Anyway.
Yeah, right. They are, and as I say, I mean, they're lunar eclipse that we had a while back is probably the easiest celestial event to observe because you can't miss it. A meteor shower is probably the second best celestial event because you don't need anything really but a lawn chair and the willingness to observe the sky after midnight. Yeah.
Well, lots of people, callers online to visit with you guys. So let's go to the phones. And Joe in Milton is up first here. Hi, Joe. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess I got an optics question.
Okay.
I've got a 8-inch telescope I bought, a reflector I bought many, many, many years ago. And if I'm focusing on something like the moon or Saturn or Jupiter, I get a nice image. But like if I'm trying to focus on a binary star or something that's more of a pinpoint, it always seemed to have kind of a tail going off to one side, and I never knew if that was problems with the mirror or my inability to maybe adjust it correctly.
Tom Hall, what do you think?
It may be problems with the mirror, but probably not. You can rest easy there.
Okay.
But all Newtonians are meant to be adjusted. You can adjust either of the mirrors that are involved in the system, the main mirror that sits down at the bottom of the tube or the primary mirror. You can also adjust the secondary mirror, but we recommend that you stay away from that one as much as possible, because usually for what you're describing, it may just be that the main mirror is pointing slightly off axis and not pointed directly at the secondary.
Okay.
So you should see three adjustment screws on the back of the main mirror cell. Mm-hmm. If it's an older telescope, it should be quite open back there, and you notice a kind of open lattice work of an aluminum casting that will hold those three screws for you.
Yeah, I've got three, wing nuts back there.
There you go. This is an adjustment that you can start at the daytime, actually, and get quite accurate with it. The trick with these, and there's several good descriptions at space.com on how to, collimate your Newtonian telescopes and that sort of thing, but it's really a pretty easy trick. You want to remove the eyepiece out of the scope itself.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to be looking through the eyepiece. And you look down through the eyepiece holder, and the image that you're going to try to adjust to is seeing your eye centered in the secondary mirror, and the secondary mirror centered kind of in the view that you get of the main mirror. You'll only have to hold your eye, you know, 2 inches to 6 inches behind the eyepiece holder itself, and you adjust one of those nuts at a time. Unfortunately, I can't really describe to you here over the radio the correct direction to twist them, because it's somewhat reversed from what you're going to think. So you'll need a little trial and error on
doing
it.
Trial and error is definitely the way to go.
There's an excellent book out by David Sauter called Star Testing Astronomical Telescopes. He not only goes through how to do that, but will give you what to look for when the eyepiece is in the telescope, and some other optical aberrations that once you get it adjusted, you know, maybe you say you have that tail coming off on your image itself, he can point you to some other things that may be involved in the setup. But I'll bet that just adjusting that primary mirror is going to cure almost all of this for you.
I've done that, I think, but it's been a long time, so we'll give that a try.
Give
again.
It a shot.
If that fails, then possibly it could be the mirrors.
Well, it could, but if you got a good image out of it at one time, the mirrors aren't going to degrade over time or change their shape.
Okay.
So you should be fine just doing the alignments on it and hoping for the best with that.
Yeah, a dirty mirror, for example, is not going to change that image that you see. So it's the adjustment of the mirror, not the state of it.
Okay.
Thank you much.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. Charles in Cambridge, your turn. Hi, Charles.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good.
I was wondering... Lately, or just a couple days ago, I saw a program talking about an artificial intelligence robot that's being built to go ice fishing on Europa.
Hmm.
And I was wondering if you had any expectations about what it might find under there.
Well, Jim Lattice, what do you think?
That's a fascinating question, and it's what planetary scientists are all debating now, and you'll find many opinions about that. There are some, of course, who think that we may find an actual zone of liquid water down there. Some who think it might be pockets, sort of subterranean oceans, but not necessarily a moon-wide ocean underneath there. And others who say, well, you know, it might just be kind of slushy. So until they actually drill down in there, it's going to be very hard to know. Although look for talk pretty soon about doing a similar sort of thing with Saturn's moon Titan, because there was just some evidence that Cassini mission that's been out there for 3 years now about. It's really remarkable how much it pays just to keep looking at something over and over again in science. And Cassini has flown by the moon Titan a number of times. And the first time it dropped that probe down, that Huygens probe, that was a fascinating thing. And we got a quick look at it. Mm-hmm. But it turns out, just looking over and over again, that the crust of Titan is not rotating at exactly the same rate that the core of Titan is rotating at, which suggests that maybe it has a layer of ocean in there, too. So...
very interesting. And we've got more interesting things coming up with our two guests, Jim Lattice and Tom Hall, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking astronomy today with Jim Lattice, director of the UW-Madison Space Place, and Tom Hall, optics specialist with Eagle Optics in Middleton, Wisconsin. Really glad to have both these guys on. And certainly if you have some questions about your telescope or your binoculars or about space, planets and everything else, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. We'd love to hear from you. And some callers online, Bob and David. Bob is first from Concord, so we'll go there. Hi, Bob. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for having me. A couple of years ago, I bought an AstroScan telescope because I was told it was a good beginner's scope, and now it seems not to be working. It rattles when shaken. I think there's a small mirror inside that may have broken off. Hmm. I just wondered if you know any place around that repairs that kind of thing.
This is the Edmund Astroscan little red telescope that you're talking about?
The little pot-bellied job.
All right. It has the little ball that sits on a three-cornered mount. And
you got
basketball and oatmeal box.
Well, you'd want to bring it out to Eagle Optics, I guess, and let us have a look at it, because the next telescope and binocular clinic isn't for a few months now.
We won't be doing one until fall, ordinarily.
So you could bring that out to Eagle Optics and ask for Tom. And I've worked on a few of those over the years. They had a straight tube version that stood up on a tripod, but those are similar.
Mm-hmm.
Use a little 3-inch mirror, and yeah, we might be able to divine what the thing that's shaking around in there could be for.
When you say it's not working, do you just not see anything when you look in the eyepiece?
Absolutely nothing focuses.
Sounds like a missing secondary
even mirror. when I'm pointed at the full moon, and you know you can't miss it.
You can do the same test that we described earlier for the gentleman. You can take the eyepiece out of the scope and look down into it there.
In the daytime,
and we'll be trying to see your eye reflected back at you through the secondary and the primary.
Okay.
If you're not seeing any of that, then something is... Yeah, seriously out of line or loose or moving around in there.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Thank you for calling. And you guys have a website, too, by the way, with the directions to your place and all that. What's your website?
One of those easy ones, eagleoptics.com.
Eagleoptics.com. All right, David in Neillsville's up next. David, hi. Thanks for calling.
Well, hi. My question is more planetary than anything else.
Okay.
I'm a retired meteorologist, and of course we all know about the tilt of the Earth's axis, but I have also been told more recently that the axis also has a wobble to it. Are you familiar with that in any way?
Sure. Jim Lattice?
Certainly, yeah. So you have the tilt, as you say, the tip that causes the seasons.
Yeah, that one I'm quite familiar with. Yeah.
Sure. And so that tilt, though, has a motion to it, which is called called precession. And
it's
if you think of a, we've all really seen this. Have you seen a toy gyroscope or a top or something?
Oh, I was going to mention top, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you'll see those. They very quickly, they start to, the axis of the top starts to wobble in a conical motion. That is, the axis of the top will sweep out a cone, if you see what I mean.
Uh-huh.
Or you could say that it points in a circle. That is, it traces out a circle. And the Earth does that. The Earth is acting like a big gyroscope or a top, except that one wobble takes about 24,000 years. So it happens very slowly, certainly over the period of a human lifetime. Unless you're an astronomer, you don't notice it, although it does significantly affect astronomical coordinate systems, and astronomers have to compensate for that motion, the precession of the equinoxes, that's called. And it doesn't stop there. Actually, there's yet another irregularity in the Earth's axis motion. It bobbles a little bit on either side of that motion. As it wobbles around, it makes a slight motion called nutation. So the whole mess is a little bit complicated, but the effects are small over a given amount of time, so we don't notice it so much.
I missed that word. I want to make sure I got it right. You call that a mutation?
The second one was nutation.
Oh, nutation.
Yeah, N-U-T-A-T-I-O-N, nutation.
N-U-T-A-T-I-O-N.
But that's much the smaller effect. The big effect is the precession, P-R-E-C-E-S-S-I-O-N, precession. And we usually call it the precession of the equinoxes, although it affects the solstices and the equinoxes both. But
okay. All right. Thanks, David, for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890 and email us at talk@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you, and we've got open lines, so we'll get you on pretty quickly. We don't see the planet Mercury very often.
No, we don't. In fact, I like to talk about the Mercury Club. I try to, whenever anybody has seen Mercury, I say, oh, you're in the club now. And one of these days I'm going to have little pins made up or something. But we're going to have an opportunity fairly soon, about the best opportunity this year, not the best ever, to see Mercury. It moves, of course, around the sun fairly quickly. That's one of the reasons it's identified with the messenger of the gods. It takes 88 days or so to make one complete. So that's the length of its year, one turn around the sun. But because its orbit is much smaller than the Earth's, we're always looking towards the sun to see Mercury, more or less towards the sun.
Yeah.
So what we really see is that it scoots out a little bit to the east of the sun for a while, and then it returns in a can cross in front of the sun, although that happens relatively rarely, then to the west of the sun, and then to the east of the sun. It's only at the extremes of those excursions east and west that we can spot it at all, and then it's only always a little bit either before sunrise or a little bit after sunset. So in the first half of May, we have one of those sunset opportunities when shortly after the sun goes down, within about 30 minutes after the sun goes down, we'll be able to spot Mercury over there in deep twilight. But it's only going to be even shortly after sunset, about 10 degrees above the horizon, which is pretty close to the horizon.
Yeah.
So the 10 degrees is about the width of your fist. If you stretch your fist out at arm's length and stand it on the horizon, the width of your fist is about 10 degrees. So if you try that around your house, chances are just the trees on the horizon and the hills and whatever. So you have to, if you want to see that, it would help to be up on a hill or on the eastern side of a lake looking west at sunset, something like that where the horizon is nice and low. But then you have the opportunity to see Mercury. So it's a... the myth, I don't know if it's really myth, the legend is that the astronomer Copernicus never saw the planet Mercury in his entire life, which is more a way of just saying, well, it's tricky. You really got to get up early and go for it if you're going to see it or stay up late.
No, I see that it's listed to be very close to the moon on May 6th? I think I had that in our listings and read on that. So May 6th, they might be able to try looking close to where the moon is, and if you get that good horizon, that'd be a good night.
Let's see. 6th is just a day after new moon, which is on the 5th. So the moon would be pretty close to the sun. That could be. In
there
which case, that might be a good guide to Mercury, since they're both relatively close to the ecliptic.
Good point. All right. Rick in Oconomowoc, it's your turn. Rick.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
You bet.
My question is pretty straightforward. I have three telescopes. I have an 80 millimeters stellar view refractor, a 102 millimeter stellar view refractor, and a 130 millimeter Celestron go-to reflector. And I have a problem aligning the reflector. I have no problems with the refractor finding stuff. But with the reflector, by the time I do the three-star alignment, I just can't seem to get it to align. It keeps failing on me.
Oh, you mean align? When you say align? You mean adjusting the go-to system when you say alignment. You don't mean the optical.
Oh. When I set up each night, adjusting the go-to system. And I think it's because the slew speeds are so slow by the time I get three stars in, and it may have forgotten where the first one is. Can you give me any hints on what to do?
Boy, they should allow sufficient time with a three-star alignment that you're not going to affect them that much, so that your observing session over the next hour is going to be affected, at least not in practice when we've had them out in the field. Let's take a guess here. How long is it before the time you're acquiring your first one and the time you're trying to, set in your third one?
Could be a couple of minutes.
Oh no, that won't affect it at all. You could probably have 15 minutes and it shouldn't.
Oh yeah,
it shouldn't affect it that much. Boy, my suspicion might be that, and I take it then that this is an alt azimuth setup for the 130. It's not on an equatorial mount.
That's correct.
Boy, my first suspicion would be the protocol for setting the three-star alignment, you need to start by pointing it north and level. Is that correct?
No. In this one, it doesn't ask you to do that.
It doesn't even ask you to try that.
No, the newer ones, they don't care about north, although level helps a lot.
Right.
If you make sure that it's level.
Okay.
But it'll even tolerate a good bit. I usually don't take too much trouble. I just kind of, level it by eye. It's not sitting on a hillside or something, so it really shouldn't affect it all that strongly.
Those three points are generating the sky globe, essentially, in your small computer. And that's, boy, like I say, that's why it's not going to affect that much, even with 10 minutes before the first and the start. It sounds to me like there's something else going on there, that one of your clutches is slipping in the drive system itself.
Okay.
Or you're... the drive itself is not reading correctly after a certain point because it might be telling it that it's pointing somewhere, but boy, it's just not slewing the telescope that full distance.
I'm not familiar with that particular drive system. Are there clutches that you have to engage or disengage in order for the controller to be able to move the telescope?
No. In fact, that's one of the disadvantages. You can't disengage it, so the only way you can operate it is with the computer. So that's why slew speeds are always slow if you want to do something.
Yeah.
Well, you can...
The fact that I haven't got it balanced quite right or don't have it pointing north might be something I could try.
Oh, you would want as good a balance as you could get, because there I could see it working on the clutched system, pulling too hard one direction and not hard enough.
Yeah, they may not have a lot of torque to move an unbalanced load. So if you think it's at all unbalanced, then have you got like a camera or something hanging on it? Or
no, I don't. And that's the second part of my question, because what I'd like to do is put a drive and a camera on either my 3-inch or my 4-inch refractor, and I was going to ask for recommendations on how to do that, what you might think would be a good one.
Hmm. Do either of those have an equatorial-style mount?
Yes. I have equatorials for both of them. Well, I take that back. I have an equatorial that I can mount either one of them on.
Gotcha.
I have an old Dixon equatorial.
And is that currently a drive-style mount? Is there a motor mounted to it yet? Or?
Oh, no, there is not.
That's something you'd want to try to acquire.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, that's going to be a very good question, and you're probably going to have to see what you can find on one of the astronomy magazines in the back to see somebody advertising a slew drive system that will attach to your slow motion control.
Okay.
If that makes sense. You're going to put a motor on instead of the hand control for the slow motion itself.
Mm-hmm.
And those turn essentially at a very slow rate of speed, you know, just fast enough so that you're moving in time with the apparent motion, of course. And there you're going to either try to find an adjustable one, or you're going to be counting the teeth on your drive system to find a motor that's driving at the correct rate for that particular mount. It's going to be a bit
okay.
of a search.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be done. And yeah, sometimes they're run by 9-volt batteries and, you know, double A's or something of that nature. You just put them out there with a battery pack, and you're only going to be driving them for, you know, the exposure of a, I would say, 10-minute shot. Is that what you're looking for? Something to do very
basic?
That's
what I don't know, because I have no idea what to do about a camera yet. That was one of the other things I was hoping you might be able to point me in the right direction on what to look for or where to look for.
Well, I'd look for a specific Astro-style camera to go with these, as those will give you the best images in the shortest length of time. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not going to have that accurate drive system here to begin with. You're hopefully going to keep your exposures under 5 minutes or 10 minutes at the very most. Because until you get the real nice equatorial-style mounts that don't have any slop in them and do have a very accurate motor drive, you're not going to have very good photographic results. But 5-minute exposures or 10-minute exposures can take out a lot of, you know, error that might be in the drive itself, and you'll get some pretty good results. So I'd look for the specific Astro cameras that, you know, let you take fairly short exposures, trail just enough to keep the lines from forming on your images, and you'd probably get pretty good results. There again, the back of, you know, the astronomy magazines these days, there's all kinds of, you know, small, inexpensive Astro cameras, most of which will fit into 1.25-inch focusers. And that's the last question I'll leave us with here. Is that do either of these scopes have 1.25-inch for their focuser format, or?
I have 2-inchers, and then I go down for my 1.25-inch eyepieces.
Oh, there you go. If you have a 2-inch format, there's lots of Astro cameras that would fit in that. But generally, they'll go to 1.25-inch for cost reasons. You should be fine in picking up one of the less expensive ones and, you know, going from there. But you'll have to start with kind of trying to find a drive that will drive at the correct rate.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing you might want to consider doing is drawing on the experience of amateur astronomers who do this kind of thing. And, for example, both Madison, there are other ones in the state as well, but both Madison and Milwaukee have very active astronomy clubs, Madison Astronomical Society and Milwaukee Astronomical Society, respectively. And they always welcome people to drop into their meetings, and you'll find people there who are really experienced, people who've tried some of those products that you see advertised there, and you can really get the lowdown.
Mm-hmm.
So doing something like that might help you.
Yeah. Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Rick's from Oconomowoc, so maybe there's could well be something there. Rick in Portage County, you're up. Hi, Rick. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thank you. I have a question concerning binoculars. I've had a pair of 8x42 Nikon Monarchs for a number of years that I use on a pretty much a daily basis, and I'm extremely pleased with them. And I think it's beyond considering. My wife has informed me now she wants a pair of binoculars, too. And my question is, I've often wondered, I think I purchased these from Eagle, and they were about $300 or so. And I'm wondering, what exactly, if I'm going to spend more money, you know, like $500 or $600 on binoculars, regardless of the brand, what exactly, am I going to put those on my face and go, Oh, my gosh, am I glad I spent $300 more. We use them for wildlife viewing, predominantly.
Birds and such, okay.
Uh-huh.
Boy, I'd be in the camp that would say you've already reached the first plateau that we try to talk people into with your Nikon Monarchs, which is that $200 to $300 price range. Your Monarchs are the straight-through body style, is that correct?
That's
roof
correct,
prism
yeah.
body style. So they're tough and durable, fully waterproof. And the Nikon Monarchs do have the phase correction coatings, or PC coatings, for that body style.
Uh-huh.
So you've at least reached that plateau. I would say if you hit $500 to $600, yes, you can get into some equipment that will have ED glass. The next step that we try to say people can get into and get measurable results out of. Mm-hmm. I don't know that it'll knock your socks off like, you know, when you look through a Swarovski or a Leica or, you know, an extremely high-end binocular. That's where we always get the wow factor of people standing outside.
How much are those?
And a lot of those are now over $2,000.
Oh, wow.
But no, the $500 to $600 range, you can get into some of the features that the best of the Germans use, that ED glass or extra low dispersion glass. It's the same thing they'll use in astro telescopes for the same reason. It tightens up the image, has less color aberration around the high contrast portions of your image. And you can take a nice step up in getting to that. Pentax has some very nice ED glasses within that range. Vortex, our parent company, has a superb piece, one of which was nominated as Field & Stream's Best of the Best Award in 2007. You can notice a bit of a difference there if you take that step up. The next thing you'll also get in that $500 to $600 range, better durability. The case structure itself is very well done in almost all the equipment that I've looked at in that price range. They'll take a bit more of a hit in travel. They'll last you your lifetime. It's a good range to get into if you can swing it.
Well, mm-hmm. Terrific. That's exactly what I was... it's exactly the information I was looking for.
Now, there's a strategy for this, Rick. The first thing you need to do is to start talking up the binoculars you have to your wife. These are the best possible. But I do the same thing with my wife, only it's with golf equipment. The new driver.
I did that with deer hunting. When she became a deer hunter, I said, well, you know, my rifle is wonderful.
There you go.
I'm going to give you this rifle, but of course that means I'm going to have to buy another new one.
An inferior one, of course.
So I think I got that down.
You got that down. Well, you've been married a while then. All right. Thanks, Rick.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Yeah, it's a strategy one develops over time when after one's married. Well, how about Space Place? What's happening at UW Space Place? I know there's some events coming up that you wanted to talk about a little bit. So what's happening, Jim?
Well, we have our usual lineup of things, which, of course, you can always find at our website, which is just spaceplace.org. We'll have we have our guest speaker every month, and coming up on Tuesday the 13th of May, we'll have an engineering professor, Robert Blick, who's a nanotechnology researcher, mm-hmm. who's going to be giving a talk there. That's at 7 p.m. on Tuesday the 13th of May, and before that, we'll have on the 25th, weather permitting, Friday the 25th, we'll have one of our sky nights. We have an observing deck at Space Place, and we set up some nice telescopes, including a 13-inch Dobsonian that we let people use themselves. They can just point it wherever they want in the sky, and then we have somewhat more guided. We have other telescopes that we operate and point. And then just coming up tomorrow night, we'll have our monthly Eyes on the Skies presentation, when we'll hand out our the May astronomy flyer. So we have lots of things happening. We even have a one of our astronomical trips coming up in the fall that I'll be leading, which we've done, I think, three times now with
that's
Wisconsin.
That's kind of fun, hasn't it?
That's a wonderful trip. I really love that trip. We go and we visit observatories in Arizona, including Kitt Peak National Observatory and Historic Flagstaff Observatory, and we go up to Meteor Crater, which is just a mind-boggling place, and we visit the Planetary Imaging Laboratory at the University of Arizona, and we even make a quick stop at the Grand Canyon. So that's a wonderful thing, and that's a Wisconsin Alumni Association. You can find out about that on their travel website or calling them up.
And that's near the end of September, isn't
that
it?
That's right. The 27th through the 4th of September through the 4th of October. So right across the September October there. So plenty of time still to check into that.
So that's and of course these things have a way of filling up. So it's
right.
Better
well,
to-
Better to call sooner. That's right. It's the trip is definitely going to go. We have all the travelers we need for the trip to go. So, but there's still a few places left, I think.
Well, that's great news. And anything else? Anything new in space that we haven't talked about yet?
I just want to mention. Tom mentioned the night of May 6th, that's right. The 1 day old crescent moon will be out in the west, and Mercury will be about halfway between that. That'll be a really thin crescent moon. A pair of binoculars might help finding that. Mercury will be below it and to the right and close to the horizon. So you'll have to look. If you find that crescent moon, look below and to the right and look for Mercury. Right. Well, let's see. We've got coming up. In fact, one thing I'm going to start mentioning as often as I can is that next year, 2009, has been designated by UNESCO and the International Astronomical Union and a growing list of organizations, Space Place 2, I suppose, I got to add on there, as the International Year of Astronomy, because 2009 is the 400th anniversary of Galileo's first astronomical discoveries with his recently invented astronomical telescope. And so there will be lots of activities during 2009, the International Year of Astronomy. There's several websites related to it. There's a parent website, an international, which I should have looked up first, shouldn't I?
Well, I'll tell you what.
I can find that in a minute. But the and then there's a national site for every country that's participating.
Well, with that, we have to close. Tom Hall of Eagle Optics. Go to eagleoptics.com for a look at their website. And also Jim Lattice of the UW Space Place. Just Google in UW Space Place and you're going to find it. Thanks again to these guys. And they'll be back. We'll do this again with them. Stay with us.